So I'm very happy to welcome Martin Parr, the Museum of Élysée. It's not his first visit here, so it's almost useless to introduce Martin Parr. But however, I'll say two or three phrases about him. Of course, he's one of the most important photographers today ever. And he joined Magnum in 1994, and he was the director of Arles Festival, and if I'm not mistaken, you're currently a photography professor at the University of Wales, is that correct?
That's true, yes, but that's really a sort of token gesture.
Oh, yeah. I think the students of the University of Wales appreciate that. So, I'll begin with a very complicated question. I said that I will ask only simple questions, but in fact, I was just lying. So, my very first question would be, what would be your definition of an amateur in photography today?
I mean, the traditional definition is someone who does it for the love of it, isn't it? An amateur photographer is someone who does it for the love. A professional is someone who does it for money. I mean, of course, it's never as simple as that. Because often the two can be the same, can't they? I mean, I do it for love, but I also am very lucky that I earn my living from being a photographer too. So I guess, if you think of the history, it's as much to do with domestic photography, snapshot photography, the photographs that people take for themselves to record their own lives, which of course are much in evidence in your show. And I think, if you like, the word that I like now is vernacular photography. Because that means it's not done to become art. It's done for a purpose, to sell something, to illustrate something, to sell an idea. In fact, it's really to do with propaganda. You know, because we are surrounded by visual propaganda. Even the family album is a form of propaganda, because most family albums, the purpose of them is to actually give the impression that your family is a perfect family and everyone's smiling, everyone's happy. The most dishonest statements, in fact, you can actually find. Because, for example, if you photograph your children, you always photograph them when they're laughing and smiling. People never photograph their kids when they're crying, because that's not what's expected of you in terms of the depiction of your own family through photography. We only photograph at weddings. We don't photograph at funerals. Why is that? Are we saying a funeral is not important? No, it's because there's a tradition, there's a baggage attached to the expectations of domestic photography and photography generally, but particularly domestic photography, which is, as I say, a form of propaganda to try and give the impression that your family is the perfect family. Because why would you want to, if you've created the family, you're a parent, in other words, and you're photographing your kids, why would you want to admit that your family is dysfunctional, which a lot of families are? Sorry, I got on to another topic, but I think it's an interesting one.
I think that the topic is very related. So, of course, the topic, I think it's almost impossible to really separate the topics. We tried in the show, but in fact they are so complex that they interfere every time. So I think that Alfred Stieglitz would love your definition, you know, that there are professionals that did it for money, and amateur, like himself, who did it for love. But if this definition was valid at the end of the 19th century, do you think it's still valid now?
No, because all the boundaries are collapsing. I mean, one of the things that's interesting about Flickr is that it's probably emerged as the most intelligent photo-sharing site. You know, it's become the brand leader. And what will happen with Flickr is that within 5 years, they will start licensing pictures. In other words, they'll be part of the sort of Getty Corbis machinery. And if you say to a photographer on Flickr, would you mind if we sell them and you get 50%? Very few people will say no. So, you know, the agencies are concerned about this. It's something, for example, in Magnum we discuss about the role of Flickr in our future and in the future of photography. So, in fact, what will happen is that not only will we all become photographers, as in the title of the show, but everyone will become professional photographers too, because all you need to do is to bung your pictures on Flickr. There's no selection process. You put everything on, a bit like Alamy. Alamy is really like a slightly more professional version of Flickr. And within 5 years, Flickr will emerge as one of the major licensing sources of imagery. which is interesting. It's a threat to the traditional aspect of how photography functions, but they've been threatened for many years now, and I think and expect that we're all used to challenges from different quarters. But yeah, I, personally, for me, I welcome all challenges. I think it's terrific. Because the other great thing about this museum and me as a photographer is that the photography audience is expanding rapidly. You know, can you imagine now how many people have signed on to Flickr? They're all potentially people who want to come to see this show and to go and see other shows of photography and to buy photographic books. There are more books published now, there's more shows now, there's more magazines now. So the audience for photography is forever increasing. That's good news for everybody, I would say, in the photography community.
For sure. Well, if we compare Flickr, let's say, with Corbis, Corbis has 70 million images, and Flickr more than 130 million. So it's considerable.
Yeah.
And we have a very interesting example in the show. Noah Molina's video have been seen by more than 5 million people on YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And then he could become a celebrated, really. Now he's really a star.
Mm-hmm.
But without the using of the traditional system, no gallery, no museum, no art critic made him celebrated. He celebrated himself with 5 million views.
No, I mean, this is fantastic. I mean, there's this wonderful story in Magnum about a Flickr story, which I must just tell you, because Bruce Davidson, who, as you all know, very eminent, well-known photographer, was up for some big advertising job doing a car. And this woman, one of the rising stars of Flickr, I can't remember her name, but this Icelandic woman who basically was a total amateur and started doing pictures, became hugely successful on Flickr, and started really because someone contacted her to market her work commercially. She got this job. She took it off Bruce Davidson. So I think this is absolutely brilliant, you know, that someone who comes from nowhere, no one's heard of, within 2 months of her career being launched, is taking a job off one of the great masters of American photography. So it's all there to play for. So it's very exciting. So the great thing is, you know, if you've got interesting photographs, because the other point about Flickr, I can't tell you how bad most of the pictures are. I mean, we see this in the site up there. The noise of this contemporary photography is relentless and ultimately nullifyingly boring. It's like when you judge competitions, most of the pictures are so bad. And you see all the cliches, all the propaganda, all the lazy old visual statements, whoever won. So this is, in effect, the downside. You know, we have this amazing resurgence of interest in photography, renaissance, whatever you want to call it. But boy, do we have to wade through a lot of rubbish in order to get to anything half decent. And, you know, for example, the show up here, which of course is very interesting, has a fantastic number of really uninteresting photographs in. But it's still a great show. Okay, that's a contradiction, of course, but it doesn't matter because most of this stuff is pretty dreadful.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't think it's contradictory. I fully agree with you that the pictures are dreadful, but they are not in the show because they would be inspected to be otherwise. I mean,
no, but I, part of the show's policy is to not censor, and I welcome this. It's terrific, and it's a sobering example of how bad most photography is.
Oh, sure, statistically. But do you think that there is a relationship between what happens today in photography and larger phenomena like crowdsourcing, for instance?
What sourcing?
Crowdsourcing, the idea to use the crowd as a source, which is not valid for photography.
You mean like how the things become popular on something like mm-hmm. YouTube or indeed on Flickr?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's just interesting, isn't it? It's people responding. And, you know, for someone like me going to YouTube, one of the things I do, you open up YouTube, you think, what should I look at? I've got 10 minutes to kill. You obviously go to the favourites, right? Sometimes these favourites are pretty bad. Sometimes they're interesting. But you see a lot of schmaltz. That's the danger. It's the schmaltz propaganda factor, more clichés. You know, in the end, that's what people love so much, and that can be very dangerous.
Oh, sure. But what I mean by crowdsourcing is the idea that the crowd would provide the same service cheaper, you know, that one could find in the crowd. Of course, 98% would be totally interesting, or 1% would be half decent, to quote you, and 1% would be decent. But this 1% will pay for the others because it will be still cheaper to
produce or to look at or to view.
And even as a supply for the image users over the world.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You mean commercial users? How are you talking about?
Commercial users, I mean communications users, any kind of use one can imagine for...
Yeah, because of course, if we're talking about Flickr becoming, starting to license, clearly what will happen is that the photographers will have the responsibility to keyword their images because, you know, there has to be then a system of finding these pictures, right?
But they did now. I mean...
Yes, I know there's a certain amount of automatic keywording, isn't there? Image recognition and such like. But I guess if it becomes licensed, the keywording will become more formal. I don't know because we don't know what's going to happen, but this is all part of what will happen in the future.
Oh, sure, it will be a very difficult problem because, as far as I know, nobody really solved the problem of image indexing ever. You know, mm-hmm. So it will be the idea now is to see how people index their own photographs and to inspire the system from that mm-hmm. point of view. But of course, any librarian or any documentalist will say that in order to index correctly, one needs a thesaurus, you know, of words and so on. So it would be interesting to see which system will prevail.
I mean, curiously, at Magnum, they don't allow the photographers to do their own keywording, which I think is rather surprising, because I think we should, because part of the way Magnum will eventually survive is by having a very good website. And part of the way, you know, at the moment we don't have any, it's extremely complicated to use Magnum, unlike, say, Corpus, because you actually have to refer to a member of staff to buy a picture and download it. We've actually starting a small experiment in London office where we'll have all the London photographers with certain clients will have 24/7 download ability. Now, this, in terms of Magnum, is a total breakthrough. Because you can imagine the frustration the Magnum staff have. Someone phones up and says, we'd like to put Susan Micellis' picture on our CD cover. They've got to get that picture. If there's no high-res scan available, it's got to be scanned. Susan has to find a negative. She has to find an assistant to scan it. They then send it forward. They then do show the cropping of how they're going to use it. And it goes on and on, you know. And often, a job is lost because... In the end, the client says, well, sod this. You know, I prefer to go to Corbis. I tried to use the intelligent picture from Magnum, but we couldn't because we had all these barriers in the way. So that's one thing that we are trying is to simplify it, and potentially there will be certain clients or certain aspects of the Magnum site which won't have those restrictions on. I don't know why I'm talking about this, but you didn't ask me about that at all, but
no,
there you go.
It's the problem of image retrieval. I mean, I think every image bank faces this. But this led me to my next question. At the entrance of the show, there is a panel with several questions. We didn't have the pretension to answer that, but the first is this process a revolution or an evolution?
I think it's an evolution, yes.
Why?
Because, you know, the world of photography is changing and it just changes gradually, doesn't it?
Well,
I mean, you know, it's curious now to think 10 years ago when digital photography was well established, many of the photographers were still saying, no, film is ultimately the thing, and now there's only the elite art market that are resisting and still saying that film is best. Everyone else is entirely digital. I mean, I shoot with digital and with film, depending on the project. I remember going to Dubai, you know, in March, 6 weeks ago, I was shooting on film because it's like an ongoing project that I started in film. It's only sensible for me to finish it in film. People were looking at me as if I was sort of something out of from Mars. I mean, come up to me. Oh, I haven't seen a film camera for years now. Let me have a look. You know, and where did you get that from? And I mean, I felt, and this is, you know, Dubai is a very modern city. It's the fastest growing city in the world. So, you know, film is virtually non-existent there. But it was really peculiar to be regarded as this strange fossil from another era.
I subscribe to different lists of photographers, and you'd be amazed to see that there are still some dinosaurs who swear on film only, you know, even today. You said that you like change, but in fact, I would quote the very old saying that nobody likes change except wet babies, you know. So really do not lie. Mm-hmm. But
also the way in which, talking about evolution, the way in which the photography market and the sort of art documentary part of the marketplace of which the Musée d'Elysée is an important contributor. The way that, you know, I mean, 20 years ago, people didn't have vernacular images in their shows. It was all authored photography. And the notion of the work of, you know, Eric Kessels and Joachim Schmidt and all these people that are now very famous for using just vernacular imagery, that was hardly was there at all. So now you actually have an exhibition, and quite rightly, you mix vernacular images with known and named photographers, and people don't think blink an eyelid. Likewise, 30 years ago, if you used colour, it was regarded as a sort of a sacrilege thing if you had it in a museum of photography, you know, because serious photography is meant to be done in black and white. It's so strange how these things are now so established, no one would even question them. 30 years ago, all these things were unheard of. So look how it's all changing. So, okay, you like to boast, I'm sure, that this is your show is announcing this, you know, revolution, but it is all very slowly evolving all the time. And I'm excited by all these changes. I think they're very good. Because, as I said, I come back to this thing of a bigger audience for photography.
Sure. Well, personally, I think that there are some aspects that are evolutive. For instance, we try to say this with the historical panels, you know, pointing that a lot of debates of today happened, in fact, 100 years or 120 years ago. But on the other side, some aspects are really revolutionary. And I think that the real revolution happened mainly in the sharing of of photography. What do you think?
Yes, no, I mean, that's a very big aspect of it, right? But I wouldn't say it's a thing unique on its own.
No, that's why I...
I mean, the digital revolutions also, you know, if you're trying to pick out one thing, it is all this ability to share has come because of the digital photography revolution.
Yeah.
So that's, if you like, a byproduct of it, isn't it?
Yeah, but at the same time, you know, a digital camera needs flicker in order to have the amateur explosion we have.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the connection of two things that finally gave the situation.
Well, I mean, flicker, although, I don't, how long has flicker been going now? Is it 4 years?
As far as I know, yeah, no, even less. It's 204.
Hmm?
2004. I mean, it's amazing because even now I feel so familiar with it. Yet it is extremely recent, isn't it?
Oh.
I know that YouTube is also equally as recent.
The cell phone, you know, has been invented in 1997 and produced only in 2000. Hmm? The first cell phone able to take photographs, the first photo phone.
Right, you know? Right.
And it's 2000 and we are at the beginning of 2007. And
yes.
It seems to be here for centuries.
Yeah. Well, the citizen journalist is something that's also very interesting. And, of course, again, that does threaten, you know, to a certain extent, the accepted authority of the photojournalist to be the only person to sort of cover these things. Now, as we well know, the most interesting pictures often taken, for example, in the London July 7th bombing of, when was it, was 2 years ago?
Yeah, 2005.
Yeah. You know, the pictures that really were the ones that we all remember from that, apart from the bus being blown up, were the pictures done on the cell phones of people emerging out of the underground in London. Likewise, with the guy that was murdered in Holland.
Yeah.
You know, there's this famous picture of a sword in his chest, isn't there, which was done on a cell phone, which surprisingly got repressed. I mean, it wasn't used. There's only one paper in Holland that actually used it.
The Telegraph.
Yeah. I thought it was going to be a really shocking picture. I only just saw it about 6 weeks ago, and it was pretty mild. So I was rather surprised that this picture had been censored by most of the press in the world.
Well, I think maybe they didn't react out of, let's say, political fears, you know. So they were... I think that publishing this would be a security risk for a lot of... Yeah? So it's not in the image, but in the political situation. It's the same phenomenon. They did not... I mean, the director of the Berlin Opera that said, we won't play Mahomet, you know.
So we
should look into this direction, I think. Hmm? So what do you think... are really the professional photographers threatened in their very existence by what is happening?
Well, that's a good question. I personally, again, I say not at all. I can only really ultimately speak myself. I mean, knowing my Magnum colleagues very well, I guess you know, the whole way in which photography is being digested and used is changing, and therefore there's a few of them, mainly the older photographers, who still dream of the days when these fantastic assignments came in from magazines exclusively for, you know, people like magnum photographers. But I would say generally the younger people, and certainly myself, I don't feel threatened at all. I feel extremely grateful to be living in an age where photography is so widely appreciated. The prices of photography in the marketplace are going up. And as I keep saying, there's this bigger audience for photography than we've ever had before. So to me, it's all fantastic news.
Well, at Magnum level, of course, I don't think that you and the others risk a lot. You know, James Natchway...
he left Magnum, remember?
Yeah, but Natchway gave a very celebrated interview, and he said mostly the same as you say now. But I'm thinking, you know, of a lot of professional photographers who do not have the name, who do not have, you know, the prestige of Magnum or the agency. Do you think they are really threatened? Do you think they should be afraid of what is happening?
Well, I personally would say they shouldn't be, but probably some are, because they're the ones that are less keen to adapt to any to the changing circumstances. There's certainly the case that fees for work, you know, for editorial assignments, even more local commercial photography, they're going down, because now that these can all be done digitally, that brings the price down, and because the magazines are less interested, as you know, in editorial photography. They want more lifestyle pictures. But there are still more photographs being used now than at any other time in the history of photography in terms of being published and used, so, and sold. So the opportunities are always increasing. And if anyone's good, they're always going to make it, I maintain.
Mm, great. À ce moment-là, donc, il ne faut pas qu'on monopolise la discussion. Donc vraiment, s'il y a des questions, c'est déjà le moment. N'hésitez pas.
Et juste une question. You told that Magnum doesn't suffer, but as they hurt the numbers...
No. The way Magnum earns its income is changing, and therefore there is no doubt that there is a certain amount of decline in terms of the traditional stock sales and such like. And there used to be search fees, and of course these have gone out the window. But the thing that's interesting is that the editorial departments are the thing that really are emerging. No, the cultural departments, they're the places that, you know, deal with exhibitions, selling prints. You know, 20 years ago, the four Magnum offices didn't have any cultural departments at all, and now they're the biggest department, especially in Paris, which is the biggest Magnum office of all. So in a sense, it is changing. So one marketplace is going down, but the other marketplace is increasing. And of course, there's the internet. You know, we have these Magnum Emotion things, which are very successful on the net. We have these portals in Slate, in slate.com. I mean, there's all kinds of activity. And of course, we're working away. We've got all kinds of people now looking at other ways that we can incorporate the internet into our future business plans, because clearly that's the thing.
Web 2.0.
Sorry?
Web 2.0.
Whatever, yeah.
Activity and all this stuff.
Yeah, but I mean, we all know. I mean, we'd be daft not to be thinking around this as the main source of income in the future. Complementing that with the ability to sell prints and to market exhibitions and do the cultural activity I just mentioned. That's not to say that, you know, Magnum's financial problems are over. I mean, the main financial problem with Magnum is that, you know, it's a cooperative, as you know. All the photographers, if all the photographers took out the money they were owed, we would be bankrupt instantly. So we're always relying on the generosity of the photographers to basically bankroll the organisation.
Yeah.
So what we do, when you become a member of Magnum, you actually become a member of a huge debt, which is on paper very unattractive.
Well, one is symbolically paid, let's say.
And how do you see the photography in 20 years? I mean, the technical...
The digital revolution will be complete, mm-hmm. insofar that it's not entirely complete. There's still some people using film. I guess, you know, someone like Gursky might still be using film in 20 years' time, but of course all these pictures are digitized. So you will have those very small niche markets that might still find a use for film. And all I can see is that the photo sharing and the image sharing sites will, as I say, become they will start licensing. So Corbis and Getty's brief reign at the top might be brought to a halt because they'll be threatened by Flickr and all these other sites. And I guess the audience for photography will continue to grow.
Okay, but which kind of business model should we build up? I mean,
best business model is to have fantastic pictures that have a unique vision and say something different, and you get away from the turgid quantities of cliches and propaganda which we see not only surrounding our lives, but we also see in the exhibition here. I mean, of course, within that there is always going to be something that's got that passion, got that edge that makes it work. But I'm always amazed, as I say again, how bad, for example, when I did, I think in 2005, Sony Ericsson gave me a phone. it was 2 megapixels at the time. That was seen as quite revolutionary. Now, probably the 5 megapixels. I'm not even
10.
Up 10, there you go, you see. So I'm not up to speed. So I went out in the summer of, I think, 2005 and took pictures, and it was downloaded onto this site that Sony Ericsson won for the K1750 or K750. So every week I put in 10 pictures, and people looked at this, and then they sent in their own pictures, right? And the idea was that I was going to judge these. Now, I started to look through, and in the end, they agreed that it was only fair that someone came in and edit them before I looked at them, because most of these pictures were absolutely dreadful. I mean, in the way that if you even Flickr, you take a sort of quick look at that, most of the pictures are boring. And cliched,
But to change my question, a few years ago you told us how you began, and you told us your photographer has to get pictures out.
Of course, yeah, and Flickr is a fantastic example of how that can be achieved very easily, wherever you are. No, I'm totally in favour of Flickr, and I'm sure, I haven't spent enough time trawling through Flickr's to find, the new stars that may be emerging on Flickr itself.
So you would begin with Flickr now?
Probably.
Question: how would you begin now?
Probably not. I would still, obviously things like photography courses, just the word of mouth. I mean, I'm currently editing a series of books for Nasrani Press, where I'm going to publish over the next 5 years 10 new monographs of emerging photographers. Now, I'm finding these people by people telling me, finding something, and I'm finding fantastic new photography coming through, and these people will have a book, and it's a fantastic position that I've been given to sort of edit this series. But the last thing I'm going to be doing is looking on Flickr for my stars of the future.
So you're changing your business model to become a producer more and more?
Well, it's part, yes. I mean, I'm an editor, a curator, and a photographer. I have these various activities, photographic books. I did the 2-volume history of photography books with a colleague of mine. So yes, I mean, it's just part of what I do. I mean, again, the two things are really coinciding. I mean, if you look at, for example, the whole idea of the diary, which is really, if you like, an extension of the amateur album, if you know what I mean. So people like, initially, Larry Clark, and particularly, say, Nan Goldin, when she did The Ballad of Sexual Dependency, which came out in 86. This is an amazing example of that sort of spontaneity, that freedom. She's really, if you like, photographing her own friends, her own activity. So it was really like a very professional family album, if you like. But of course, what she was doing was quite extreme. She was using drugs. She was being beaten up. You know, so her life was quite dramatic, unlike most people's lives, which are pretty pedestrian. In terms of my own work, I mean, of course, it's intuitive, and you know, being there at the right place only means that you're seeing a very strong edited version. Because I'm a very busy photographer, I take a lot of pictures. And I take, you know, more bad pictures than most people, only because I take more pictures than most people. But in order to achieve those few ones of any resonance, you know, I've taken a lot of absolute rubbish. I just want to reassure you that that's the case. And of course, you know, I'm very aware, I'm very mindful of the pitfalls of photography. Most photographers, you know, when you're teaching photography and you've got students coming in, and they're showing you projects, and they're very excited because they've just discovered that, you know, how exciting it is to go and do a circus or to go and photograph in a zoo. They perhaps don't know that these are some great cliches within photography, and everybody and 100 people before them have done, you know, quite interesting projects around that because they're sort of quirky and attractive events. So therefore, you know, photographers are very lazy. They like to, you know, we find it much easier to respond to something dramatic, which is why most people, when they photograph, they only photograph when they go on a holiday, or they do something exceptional, like going to a wedding, but not a funeral, as I mentioned earlier. So, you know, photographers are very drawn into laziness, and inherent laziness, so they're not thinking so much really about where their photographs fit in terms of the depiction of contemporary society, or the interpretation of contemporary society. So this is often a debate I end up having with students, where they haven't really thought through why and how and what they're doing. And I imagine a lot of people with Flickr don't have that sort of consciousness, if you know what I mean.
Well, I would like also to give a very short answer to your question, which is very interesting, because I think that there is a whole amateur tradition which is bound with rules for all the tradition of the photo clubs. And, you know, at a certain moment you learn that the sky would be at one-third of the height, you know. If it's not, it's not right. You know? I think Mr. Park would tell us a lot about this. It would be my next question. So, in fact, there are some amateurs who are lucky enough not to be in a photo club, and they could be luckier than the professional, because a lot of professionals go to bad schools. You know, so being in a bad school, it would be
it's a bad school.
Well, we can discuss that. But being in a bad school would be even worse than not being taught at all, in my opinion.
Actually, one of the things I would have had in the show, I've got this fantastic book done in 1905 called "Why My Photographs Are So Bad." It's by someone like Charles Swan, and in this, he looks at all the mistakes that typical photographers make. Wonky horizons, you know, having your own reflection in the photo. And you look at these photographs and you think it's an exact agenda of much of the photography language in contemporary practice that has emerged in the last 20 or 30 years, where in effect they've borrowed the sort of, if you like, the inherent mistakes, is what you're talking about, really, that photography has the ability to do very well. And at the end of this book, he's got a chapter where he actually says, "Now I'm going to indulge myself and show you some photographs that are really good." And of course, these photographs are just dreadful. And it's the ones that are bad. And he did this 100 years ago. So it's so fascinating to see how that language, and in effect, as you know, many photographers from Winogrand, myself, you know, we borrow that what we call a snapshot aesthetic, which has this spontaneity where things going wrong can become part of the vocabulary in the language and are very positive, whether it's flash and snow, making a blob, all these mistakes, the reflection, you know, all the things that you're not meant to do, you know, in terms of the traditional expectations of amateur photography, you break those rules and you make what looks like art. But often now that's not the case anymore. It's not as simple, because the language is very sophisticated and it's moving on and it's changing constantly. And as new photographers emerge, you know, because what does one do when you're confronted? If you go to Arles, for example, the festival in the south of France, and you see the 500 books that are put in for the competition every year, you know, for the best photography book, it's a very sobering and interesting exercise to look through the 500. And the 500 is probably, you know, a third of what's published that year. So, because many Japanese publishers don't bother putting in, many other publishers, privately published books, don't. So it's just the tip of the iceberg. So if you assume there's 2,500 photography books published every year, most of them are pretty, you know, not that interesting. And the reason why is because they're very much to do with generic photography. If you look at students' work, you can go and you look at students' work, and as you're sitting there, within 3 minutes, you can ascertain where they're coming from. You can see who they've been influenced by. You can see certain photographers have influenced, you know, people like Nan Goldin, Luca de Corsia, Gursky. You know, you can see the people who've really defined the vocabulary, the language, and the culture in the last 20, 30 years, and people are picking up on that. But just occasionally, you'll find something that you cannot decipher, and you cannot work it out where it's coming from. And that's the thing that interests me, because all the time, it'll be the simplest idea that is, in the end, the best one. And you think to myself, why did no one think of that before? It's so brilliant and so simple, you think, that's terrific. I mean, I must just tell you, the first book I'm doing in this Nasraeli press series is a book about the digital revolution insofar. It's called Darkroom. And this photographer in Canada, a guy called Michel Campeau, went out and he photographed in 70 darkrooms or 80 darkrooms of all his friends that he knew who had darkrooms. And he just did a simple set of still lives in the darkroom, okay? You think, what an unpromising subject. But it's absolutely brilliant because, you know, anyone in the photography world has been in the past in a darkroom, and all those smells and those wires and the tapes and the absolute haphazard nature of the darkroom, done with this full colour close up imagery, is very brilliant because it's so simple. Why had anyone thought to do an exploration of the darkroom? And it's a very good way to sort of celebrate an end of an era as he does these digital pictures in analogue darkrooms. It's a great set of work.
So?
Your opinion about alternative photography? I mean, this with the net, we find more and more opportunities to...
Alternative being what? I mean, what is alternative photography now?
Alternative techniques.
I mean, you mean like... Oh, right. Yes, yes. I mean, I'm not that interested in alternative techniques. To me, it's a sort of nostalgia. Yeah. But I mean, I perfectly understand why people want to pursue it. Mm-hmm. But it's not to me what is most interesting. You're probably a bromoil worker. Well, that's okay. Let's see, two people have walked out because in protest.
Well.
Take pictures of their family, always happy and perfect. And you say that professional photographers are they interested? Are they drawn to drama?
Professional insofar that you mean the documentary, the photojournalist, or the advertising? Because, you know, if you're an advertising photographer and you're photographing things to sell, which is a form of propaganda, the idea is you have to make the thing or the scene, whether it's a travel photography, for example, to make it look as attractive as possible. You have to basically lie about how it looks in order to make the successful photograph. But this we all understand, but we don't acknowledge. If you go to a supermarket and you look at a packet of beef burgers or a packet of lasagna or any packet, and then you look at the thing inside, it has no resemblance to the thing on the package, right? So we're basically being sold a lie constantly. But people don't accept that or think about it so much because it's so much part of our society and the way we digest images that people don't really sort of think about it. Even the family album. If I was to say to someone, I think your family album is a great example of propaganda, they'd probably be rather surprised. But if you start thinking about it, what it means, what it signifies, if you go through the pictures, you know, I think you could understand that. But most people don't really think about how photography is representing society and how we're using it and how we're reading it.
But I think there's kind of a moral issue there as well. I mean, like I was just looking at some photographs, you know, like 9/11 or someone picking up on the door and all these people with their mobile phones taking pictures. It's like, I think there's kind of a barrier taking a picture of someone who's in pain or something.
Well, yeah, I agree. That's a... Yeah, there is a grey area, and there are lines that you might not want to cross, you know, and I that's a different issue. But I agree, that's you know, you need sensitivity to that. But in a sense, you could argue that, you know, someone like Philip Blenkinsop, who, I don't know if you know this photographer, who does pictures that are really brutal, and he's often is censored. But in the end, I'm sort of quite happy that someone like that does these pictures. I mean, he goes to wars and he shows war in a really unpleasant way, in the way that most war images we see are sanctified, you know, they're sort of sanitized, if you like, yeah, so that you can have a little bit sort of something nasty, but not that much. So you could also say that that's, you know, heavily censored and heavily sort of manipulated.
What do you think of the censorship?
Censorship in general?
Yes, by what you're talking about, newspapers censoring certain pictures. What's your position in that?
Well, it's very difficult to have a, you know, an overall position on this. I mean, clearly I'm sort of anti-censorship, but I accept that, you know, there is, you know, censorship in places like Muslim societies and such like. And I understand why that's the case, and I wouldn't want to threaten that or challenge that. You know, it's just you either play the rules of that game or you don't.
But do you think it's your position, your own position has changed in the last years?
Not particularly. I mean, I censor my own work, you know, because when you take a picture, it doesn't necessarily mean you want to use it. I always say, take it and then decide what to do with it after. So there are pictures that I just don't use. I mean, I'm... you know, people may be surprised, but I'm very careful about showing people a sort of mega fat just for the sake of it, you know. Although I'm photographing the consumer society, I'm not actually that interested in photographing people who are so fat that they're gross, because that to me is just too easy. So if they creep in or I look at the pictures, I will usually censor them out, or I just don't take them anyway.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm fairly careful about that. Well, as I would welcome someone in a wheelchair in a picture of mine. You know, if someone moves into the frame and they're in a wheelchair, I'd say, great. But if it's a fat, gross person, I wouldn't. And I don't know why or how, because, you know, fat, gross people are part of society now, especially with the way, you know, we're all eating junk food more than ever before. But I don't want to make it look as if it's, you know, exploitation, which, you know, to a certain extent it is, because all photography is a form of exploitation. I'm one of the few photographers actually admit that. Most of them don't want to. I can tell you, because I hear them talk.
That's 9/11, the political climate, a lot of place in the world has changed.
Mm-hmm.
And is your role as a photographer changed as well?
Well, I think, you know, 9/11, what's happening, homogenization, globalization... It means that, you know, the viewpoint of an individual, which is ultimately what a photographer is needed more now than ever before, because the danger is that, you know, societies, pressure groups, whatever, you know, take over, and therefore there is no voice of the individual. That's why, for example, I still, you know, believe in the quality that Magnum has in terms of its ability to be a group of individuals with individual voices. And that's why, for example, despite the fact that I've mentioned we're bankrupt, we've resisted. We could have all sold up to Getty or Corbis, retired with $1 million each, you know, had no debts, but we'd have lost our integrity. So that's why we always resist anyone trying to come and buy us up, because in the end, we think people will respect us for the fact that we've stuck to our guns. And although everyone perceives Magnum as being, you know, arrogant and wealthy, we are ultimately just bankrupt.
Mm-hmm.
You still feel free enough to do what you like?
Of course. I mean, one of the principles of Magnum is that everyone does their own thing, and then the offices, with their professional help, facilitate a way in which you can, you know, make it work. You know, because I don't want to be phoning up a magazine, selling a picture. You know, I want someone else to do that. So it gives me the chance to do what I want to do, which is to go out and take more pictures and create more projects. So, yeah. That's the whole point. It protects you from the day-to-day drudgery of selling your pictures. Looks what? Like we finished.
No.
Oh.
Not yet.
You have more difficult questions for me.
Yeah, I'll find a very difficult one. That, what would be the relationship? You mentioned citizen journalism. I would like to quote, I don't remember now the name, it was a deputy editor of New York Times, said, of course we are very interested in citizen journalism, because the most expensive thing for us to pay are journalists.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So Do you think really that the definition of the amateur photographer is he's successful only when he happens to be, as Aaron Boxma for Ter van Hout, the Dutch example mm-hmm. you gave, it's happened to be there by chance? It's just to be at the right moment in the right place?
Yeah.
Is that
obviously, you know, that helps. And if you've got any sense, you would take your pictures. You wouldn't sell them straight to CNN or give them straight to CNN, because they, of course, will exploit them and make lots of money. Or the BBC, they're all known to be potentially crooks when it comes to people coming in. You'd have to take your picture to one of these many sites now that, you know, manage pictures, citizen journalism pictures, to the media.
Yeah,
because then you're going to get a decent deal.
Yeah, BBC policy was very funny because they say we will not pay. They have a disc of six dealing only with amateur images, mainly videos, not photographs, mm-hmm. but the problem is almost the same. And they say we do not pay. And then, of course, they have IT&T and as competitors, and they paid, and they lost a lot of good stuff. And now they say the rule is that we are not paying, but for exceptional thing,
We will pay.
We will pay.
Yes. Yeah. So. No, that's a great example of British hypocrisy. Can we think of more? I can give you more.
Sure, give us.
No, I'm only joking. I'm sure I can.
When they arrested the bombers to be, you know, the bombers which did not explode 2 weeks after the bombings, the real bombings, then Nick Safadeus, I remember the name, he was on a balcony and he saw the policeman blocking the area, and it was not a photograph, it was a video, 28 seconds,
mm-hmm.
and he was smart enough to put it on action. ITAT paid 80,000 euros. You know?
I mean, that's one of the things that's going to happen, is that the press photographers are going to be expected to take a video camera as well, as you know, because that's become potentially, you know, that's one of the things that will take off, is that on all the internet sites for newspapers now, they won't want photographs, they'll want video clips.
Huh.
And they'll send out their photographers, they're probably doing it now anyway, with a video camera. Perhaps it's a video camera with such a sophisticated megapixels that you can take any frame and that's good enough to be printed as well. You know, but that to me, it potentially is a bit depressing, but why not? I mean, if that's what happens, happens.
Why would it be depressing for you?
Because it means that I suppose the still photograph is one of the things that might be a threat to the still photograph. But in the end, you know, if we still have newspapers, and we don't know in 30 years' time whether we'll have newspapers or not, but I suspect they will survive in the way that, you know, people said 10 years ago, well, the photographic book's as good as dead, because now that we have the internet, you can download your book from the internet, you know, with people like Zone Zero. But of course, you know, I would never bother to download a book from the internet unless it was something really quirky or interesting, because I love the tactile feel of the book.
Yeah.
So, as we've just discussed, there are more books now published today than ever before.
Yeah, happily, there are some book fetishists that are...
Yes, I elect myself as being a big example of this.
We are at least two on this side, you know. I hope there are a lot of them on the other side. So do you think that press people using video will be their way to compete with television, using the television's own weapon?
Yes, I guess so, because we've always said, you know, that the introduction of the television was the first nail in the coffin of photojournalism, and there's some truth in that. So it's ironic that you know, they may now kill off television.
Well, if every article in New York Times will be accompanied by video, mm-hmm. then why look at the news? You know, you'll have this almost the same in the newspaper in the morning.
We do not know what will happen, but it's all going to change, whatever happens. And it's always going to be interesting.
Sure, prediction.
But the idea is, you know, I come back to this individual voice in our homogenized times, you know, connecting with a subject matter, doing it with passion, resolving a set of pictures, you know, coming out with a personal statement. There's always going to be room for that, because we still, whatever the process and whatever the method, we still need stories that touch us as human beings. You know, and the great thing about photography, you know, it doesn't have the language barrier. You can still show a set of photographs that can touch someone in Japan, in Australia, in Peru, etc. You know, and that's the great thing about photography. It's such an international language, and it translates and travels very well, and it's hugely democratic and popular. So we still need people telling stories and showing pictures and making intelligent statements through images. So, you know, that thing, you can never take us, you can never take that away from us, whatever the technology, whatever the marketplace, whatever happens.
Question?
I just wanted to get back to that topic of amateur photography. I know that you're very attracted to vernacular photography and objects, and I just wonder what makes a boring photography a good one?
Yeah.
Could it be that it's just so boring that it's really good?
Of course, that is often the case.
You just love this?
Yeah. I mean, it's a very interesting fine line, you know, because something can is you know, I've been slagging off some of the images in Flickr and saying they're boring, but in fact, there are many good pictures on Flickr too. But what's interesting is that this stuff needs editing. So, for example, Eric Castles and the Useful Photography, which you may have seen, they have it in the bookshop. Eric has pictures in the show. When he orchestrates these images, the boring pictures, and he does it in an intelligent way, he makes it interesting, okay? So it's really, it's the editing and the way these things are put together that make it engaging. You know, I mean, I always think it's ironic that out of the books, I've done like 30 books, the one that's been most successful was not ones where I took the pictures, called Boring Postcards. And of course, the reason why this was successful is because of the title. And the whole point of this was to show, if you like, the utopian society being built up in America, in England and Germany after the war, and where everything new was built. And now, when we see postcards of these signs and images of hope, they look rather funny and bland. You know, the idea of a motorway, a photograph of a motorway in a postcard, or a shopping, in a really bland, boring shopping centre. And that, of course, is the thing that made that series take off. And of course, the pictures aren't boring at all. They're absolutely fascinating because they have all that, you know, they're very well and clearly photographed, nothing pretentious, you know, just absolutely straight on. So very good images. So it's a fascinating area. And of course, it's very, you can talk about it, but there aren't really any quite rules. But what you do notice is that when you see Eric Castle's contribution upstairs and you compare it to the unedited Flickr, you know, his is so much more interesting than the barrage of boring pictures to be found on Flickr or anything else. I mean, the noise of them is always attractive, because if you put a wall and you put any photograph up in a grid, in repetition, it just has a natural, you know, pleasant sort of air to it. It doesn't matter how bad or good they are, it'll always look good. Just photographs on walls in a grid always look terrific. Doesn't matter how bad they are. And that's why the Flickr pictures as you walk in are very interesting, but when you start to look at the individual pictures, you falter to find something that's quite interesting. So it's to do with the editing, I'd say, of these pictures and the way you use it. And it's really the editor as author. So although it's vernacular photography done by unknown people, the person that's brought the project alive are the likes of Joachim Schmidt, Eric Kessels, and, say, Hans-Peter Feldmann, who did it 30 years ago, 40 years ago, in the 70s, because he's one of the people who first sort of took that line and exploited it.
Well...
you worked some time ago on Siri... photo booth, I don't know how to say in English, portraits of you taken from photographers abroad.
Yes, now I've done this, I did a project called Autoportrait, which is an ongoing project where I go and have my photograph taken at a different photographic studio around the world. Now, when I started this 10 years or so ago, of course, most of the studios were still using film. Now, you go around the world and the film ones have virtually, you know, disappeared. There's a few in places like Portugal where they even make hand-coloured black and white pictures, but I'm sure in another 5 years they'll be gone as well. And now, of course, you have, it's dominated by digital pictures. So I've been very lucky insofar the digital revolution within that sphere has brought up a new variety of different possibilities and the way you can montage pictures very easily. So there's a sort of new kitsch imagery to be found in portrait studios, which are digital, which are just as interesting as the sort of traditional... sort of picture. So I've been very lucky in terms of my timing in inspecting this project in this particular time. And although I did a book, I think in 2000, I will do another book eventually of the ones, because I've got some fantastic pictures since then, mainly with these, a lot of them with digital kitsch portraits. So yeah, it just continues. It's always fascinating, endlessly fascinating.
And so you're traveling a lot in emerging markets, and how do you see?
Yeah, I mean, I mean, the best one I've had in the last 3 years, I got in Dubai. That's hardly emerging. Do you call that emerging? I guess I've got pictures from China and India as well recently. Mm-hmm. But the Dubai one, done in this digital studio, was terrific. Yeah, I almost wet myself when I saw this picture and said, please take a picture like that of me. Went back the following day to pick one. I ordered another 10 so I can just have them, so I can sell them eventually. Strangely.
Are there projects you're working on?
Well, I'm just doing Parking Spaces is a book that's coming out in next month. I've just finished this project where I've been to 41 countries over the last 5 years and photographed the last car parking space available. And the idea being that one of the things that unites us all globally is, you know, this desire and frustration at somewhere to trying to find somewhere to park your car. So I photographed the last car parking space where you could have put your car. It's always surrounded by other cars. Of course, there may be other parking spaces in the car park. We don't know. That's all lies. You know, all photography is a form of fiction, as we know. And I'm making this into a wedding album. It'll be an edition of 1,000. So it has a very precious feel to it. So you open it up. It's a beautiful album, tissue paper, a box. And it's just got that mentality of a wedding album to show the sort of preciousness of what I've been able to demonstrate. And this is really, if you like, it's a great way of just dealing with the whole notion of cars, how many cars there are in the world. I mean, it's sort of ironic, but of course it doesn't say it's ironic at all. It just says it's about parking spaces. But that's the plan. That's the idea behind it.
Where did it take these ideas?
where did it
take from these ideas?
I don't know. It just occurred to me. And I thought, that's a silly idea. I often try ideas and they don't work. And then I drop them, and then sometimes they're so silly that they sort of work.
Like you're taking pictures in the rain, your first series.
The ring flash.
In the rain.
In the ring.
No, in the rain.
In the rain.
Oh, in the rain, bad weather, yes. Bad yes. Weather. Yes.
I would like to get a little bit back to the show and the problematics of the show. So psychologists are amazed at the fact that teenagers who are so reluctant to get photographed, mm-hmm. now they're crazy about photography and mm-hmm. they photograph themselves
constantly. Yeah.
It's a very new thing. What do you think about this change in approach to photography? It's that they appropriated photography.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's all, I come back to my usual answer. I think it's fantastic. I mean, what can I say? You know, the more people using and taking photographs, the more the whole photography culture benefits, because in effect, you're pushing more people into that arena. Now, I'm not saying everyone's going to ultimately be an intelligent user of photography, but, you know, it's just great. It gives photography that... I mean, it's the most democratic art form in the world, you know, so you see people using it. We're all photographers now. It's how can we be anything but fantastic news to everybody?
Do you think it's a real democratization then?
Yeah, I mean, with its problems, it is ultimately the most democratic art form. You know, there's no question about that. There are more. I mean, I don't even know how many. You've probably got statistics about how many photographs are taken every year.
I think I have the images. In 2007, there were more than 7 billion.
Mm-hmm. Is that all? I would have thought more.
7 million?
7 billion? Yeah, no, but I thought billion. Even more.
Well, these are the estimations for 2007, I found.
Right. Well, I just thought it would be more, but there you go.
It's almost one photograph per capita, you know, it's mm-hmm. per person in the world. So mm-hmm.
Well, I know there'll still be more people without a camera than with. Yeah. But that also will change. Because, of course, you say, what is my agenda? My agenda now is to photograph the wealth of the world. You know, in the way that it's quite traditionally accepted for a photographer to photograph famine, right? That's not questioned. I'm really now, my job now is to go around and photograph wealth. Because wealth is the thing that'll do us in. So most of the projects I do are centered around this idea. How do you photograph? We are creating so much money in the world, so much wealth, of which I'm benefit as well. like, you know, the marketplace in photography, everyone's getting wealthier. That's really the only thing I'm interested in now, is to show manifestations in an interesting way of people and societies becoming wealthier.
The statistics I remember now, it's the estimation for cell phones, for taking pictures. I mean, they estimated 890 million for 2007, and they raised it to 1 billion 100 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one out of seven, more than one out of seven people in the world, they have a cell phone mm-hmm. capable to take pictures. So mm-hmm. it's extraordinary. If you compare, I mean, of course, in Africa and in Asia, it will be much lower.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Here, we won't search you, but I think that everyone in the room has one cell phone with him. No?
Yeah, but most of people are not using it, only for weddings or car crashes.
In fact, they do. In fact, the research shows that they do. They do a lot of things. For instance, they do to arrange their hair. They do images because they are too lazy to take notes in the class. They photograph books they cannot afford to buy. There are a lot of uses, and mm-hmm. even in Japan now it's the way fashion of hamedori. I mean, using it to film your own sex performance. Right? So there are a lot of uses no one thought before, and people are very creative with it. There is a site I remember, but I think Matthias Brugman would know. They recommend to put a camera behind your back to really know what's happened behind your back, and they will photograph continuously. And there is a special device to put it on a site to have your memory always empty, you know. And maybe when I'm speaking, there are 10 others I don't know yet.
Yeah, but that's just a question, generally speaking, about technology. But now our memory, I mean, the memory of humankind is more digital, especially photograph.
Mm-hmm.
In 20 years, I mean, the older people who are buying photographers to take wedding pictures, for example, they have it on CD-ROM.
Mm-hmm.
20 years, you can no more read them if you're not renewing.
Yes.
What's your opinion on this? This is real.
No, that is a potential problem. And. Because you know, I have an office in London where, you know, I have some. You know, we have all the pictures. You know, because most of my output has been up to now on analog. So of course we've still got the negatives. So we scan those pictures. But of course now that I'm shooting much more digital, I have to think and be careful about protecting, you know, saving those images. So you know, we put them on gold discs. And all kind of, I mean, I have someone who does that all for me. But I agree with you. This is a potential downfall or problem with digital images that we haven't yet dealt with is the protection and keeping these and preserving them.
No,
but I guess this will be dealt with because it's such a huge industry that it'll self-diagnose and something will happen.
I mean, all the stuff we put on the internet, YouTube is full of creativity which has a meaning. I mean, so Flickr and all this stuff, the people are not keeping them because mm-hmm. they are on Flickr, and in 20 years it will disappear. I mean, mm-hmm. our history.
Yeah, yeah.
'Cause it's,
well, I still print out pictures, so you know, I keep a sort of master archive. So even if it's film or digital, I print it out. So I've always got a picture of everything.
Oh, it's a huge space.
It is a huge space, yeah.
I have a question. Sorry, I don't speak very English.
C'est pas grave. Vous pouvez la poser en français.
En fait, j'aimerais savoir, par rapport à ces photographies de Jean, quelle était sa manière de les approcher et en fait, quel ressenti qu'il avait par rapport à eux. Est-ce qu'il avait de l'empathie? Est-ce qu'il les aimait? En fait, c'était le rapport entre les deux. Parce qu'il dit qu'il veut faire ça avec plaisir, mais est-ce que il aime les sujets qu'il photographie, ou est-ce que c'est un peu la peur d'eux?
Well, it's the question is about your relationship with your models. Do you love them? Do you have any empathy with them, or are you afraid of them?
Well, I mean, I generally sort of like people. You know, I mean, why would you dislike them? I mean, I do a critique of society where I'm not so much critiquing individuals, I'm critiquing the society of which they're part. That's always a dilemma, of course, but in the end, you have no alternative but to use real people being themselves. Yeah? But yeah, generally speaking, I mean, people often write that I'm very cynical and very sarcastic. I don't think I am. I think I'm mischievous, you know, and respectful. But people can think what they like, of course. But it is a critique. There's no question about that.
Do you always ask for their consent?
No. Because what happens is when you're photographing in a room or a place or on the street, you know, I have an antennae which tells me when I have a problem. You know, you can see certain people reacting in a certain way, and generally either avoid them or just move on because there's plenty of other people. Otherwise, there is a sort of unofficial consent that has been given where you've picked up the camera, you've photographed someone, but they're too busy talking or drinking or eating or whatever. So, you know, as you become a photographer and you photograph people over many years, you get to understand when there's going to be problems. So, you know, I can look around this room and pick out a few people that I know would be problematic. For example, I'm not going to tell you who you are, but you just have that sensibility to the problem. No, one occasionally you photograph someone and there is a problem and you have an encounter and... Yeah, but this is like once every twice a year or something like that.
Yeah.
But this is often, you know, when you're photographing on a beach and someone, you know, parents very worried because you photographed a kid. You know, this is something that happens now, which didn't happen 30 years ago, where people are much more aware of that problem of photographing children. You know, and so I tend not to photograph so much on beaches as I used to, even though it's one of my favourite places, because of that problem. It upsets me that people think that I might be a paedophile.
I thought of the same thing. I was in an airport recently and there was this little kid that was black with curly hair and she was like 2 years old and with a bottle, and I said, oh my god, this is a picture. And the mother was next to her, and at the end I said, I don't dare, because mm-hmm. people, you know, she said, who is this person who wants to take mm-hmm. my kid? And I sort of backed up.
Yeah, yeah. No, I think it's more difficult to photograph on the street now than ever before, because mm-hmm. people are aware of these things a lot more, they're aware of their rights. But coming back to your original question, no, I never ask or get model releases or anything like that. I mean, if it's, you know, if I'm doing a fashion shoot, we're using real people, we get consent, of course. If you're doing a portrait, you get consent. But otherwise, no, I don't.
Spontaneous.
Yeah.
Do you happen to know Tony McGee?
Tony McGee? No.
In London, he's a major photographer.
Oh dear, I don't know, no.
Oh, he's working for mm-hmm. different magazines. He's American.
Right, and he's American living in London?
He lives in London since mm-hmm. 3 years.
I don't know him, no.
We meet him sometimes.
How important is the knowledge of the technique for the photography?
Well, I mean...
Actually, we're seeing that you need always less knowledge of the technique to make a picture.
You're right. I mean...
So, do you think it's...
It's point and shoot now, isn't it?
Yes.
Yeah.
No place.
Yeah. So, I mean, of course, the fact that I... Even though I'm no great technician, the fact that I understand apertures and things like that and the relation of flash to ambient light... These are very useful things to understand. But of course, the great thing is now that anyone can take a picture without being intimidated by the technical thing, which in the past was a big factor in intimidation. So I welcome that. I think it's terrific.
So do you think it's good?
Yes, of course. I want it to be easier so more people do it.
You need to have the knowledge to make a good picture.
But that's... There's two different things here. There's the technical knowledge and then there's the aesthetic knowledge, or the aesthetic understanding. So to make a good picture, you don't need much technical knowledge at all. You can point and shoot. But to actually make a meaningful body of work, you need to understand where your connection is and where your passion is and how you can articulate that and make it into photographs.
To put
that's
it
a different matter, isn't it?
Yeah, to put it in a very short way, I would say that it's easier to shoot and as difficult to point.
This point makes me very curious. Yeah. Can we go back to the exhibition, please? Is it possible?
Sure.
Yes. The interesting thing is, it's also an experiment for this museum.
Mm-hmm.
It's a classical, traditional-based museum, I think,
mm-hmm.
in a way. Regarding the exhibition being a process, challenging the frame of the museum, suppose I challenge you as a new curator and the exhibition gets a follow-up. What do you change, or what might you want to change, or add something or leave something out?
I mean, I think this is a terrific exhibition, even though I think some of the pictures in it are not good. But whatever happens in a show like this, we learn from that process. So, you know, I think it's very good that this museum did this process and they did this exhibition, they invited all these people. And, you know, we need to have the noise of all these pictures, you know, to sort of really understand what's happening now in photography. So I think it's a very good exhibition. Now, in terms of, you said, what would I do? I mean, had I been here, you know, curating it, I might have put in a few things, but many of the things that the curators here selected are things that I think are absolutely the right thing to show. So you could fine-tune it, but I would have put this "why my photographs are so bad" thing in, because that to me is one of the most illuminating things that I've seen within that area of concern. But that's just the one thing off the top of my head that I might have put in.
Yes, I understand, but the interesting thing is, it's a work in progress. Not
yes.
Only, the exhibition as a system is a work in progress.
Yes.
Suppose visitor one in week one comes, discovers in week two that there are several images lost or done or added, etc. So you have to be conscious of that idea of being of making an exhibition as a progress.
Sure.
Or a process.
Yep.
Right. Okay. So then, still, I want to challenge you, if I don't mind. Because interesting things, how you reflect on it, how you, you know, hearing you talk. Suppose in the role as a photographer curator.
Mm-hmm.
Step in now. I offer you the possibility to cut in the process of this exhibition. What do you do? What should you do?
Well, I mean, it's a very difficult thing to answer because I haven't had a chance to fully digest the show because I only came here 15 right. minutes before.
Yes.
You know, so it hasn't really sunk in. But what would I do to change the exhibition?
Yes, yes.
No, I mean, there might have been a few things I'd have put in, but
what would you do?
Well, I mean, I gave you that one example. I haven't looked at it enough. I haven't spent enough time thinking and looking
okay.
about that whole process fair. To truly decide. So it's slightly unfair.
Okay,
but you know, let me put my credentials on the table. You know, I'm a great believer in vernacular photography, found photography, amateur photography. I mean, when I was the curator for Arles, one of the shows I commissioned, which I think really worked very well, was I gave this dealer, curator guy, you know, a brief to go and find pictures taken in Arles. Because one of the things about Arles that's interesting is that all the people come from all around the world to the festival, and yet there's never any pictures of Arles there. So the first thing I commissioned was to do a set of pictures that we knew had been taken in Arles. And he found some fantastic imagery from all kinds of sources, you know, inevitably vernacular. So, you know, that sort of way of thinking is one that I'm very much in favour of. I mean, the difference there is that he tended to isolate, you know, when we did the show, he inevitably isolated the things because it wasn't like the grid wasn't available of the Flickr downloaded pictures that that they had the ability to do here. It wasn't that type of show. But, you know, I'm a great believer in vernacular imagery. And I know that Kessels is doing a big show in Arles this year. which will be
one last year, or 2 years ago.
Yes, but he's doing a new one now. Well, that was useful photography. Now he's doing one of how to love your pictures extended thing that he did in Göttingen or Eindhoven last year. Sorry?
Utrecht.
There you go. You see, you know more about it than I do. Yeah.
Specialist as a photographer, so but if I may say so, I can't let you go.
Well, look, we're boring our audience now. I think it's time to, otherwise, it's too much.
Well, we'll take just one more question. One more.
Where did you buy sandals?
Well, this is a good question. This is a pair of sandals that I've had for over a decade, and it's my favourite pair. I can't get another pair like them, so I don't. They're made by Clarks, and they stopped making them, 7 years ago. So I just keep wearing them.
This is a very good idea for a subject which, as far as I know, has not been photographed yet. A book about photographers, celebrated photographers' sandals, so people here can look into it. So I'll thank a lot Mr. Martin Parr for accepting our invitation and for this meeting. And I thank you for your interest. Et en français cette fois-ci, je vous invite tous demain, donc demain matin à 10h30, Monsieur Fred Richin, qui est professeur à l'Université de New York et un grand spécialiste de l'image digitale, va nous parler dans cette salle à 10h30. Et à 14h30, donc la table ronde qui va réunir Monsieur Richin, Monsieur Parr, Monsieur Jonathan Lipkin, Monsieur André Gunther, le directeur du musée, M. Wewing, Luc Debrenne et moi-même, donc à l'aula du musée olympique à 14h30. Merci à tous.